Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this week's episode, how police interact with citizens of color has been the subject of many disturbing news stories lately. The fact that some of these cases made the news at all is part of the story. The increasing presence of video recordings puts a spotlight on questions of racist policing. Are incidents on the rise or just getting more attention? University of Washington professor Megan Ming Francis has studied the ramifications of biased policing and dealt with them personally.
Why a lot of black people have a deep suspicion and distrust of police is not something that just happens because we see Michael Brown or we see kind of Freddie Gray. It's a really, really long history that has placed us in where we are right now.
Bias in the United States criminal justice system is well documented. A 2014 report by the Washington, D.C. nonprofit The Sentencing Project came to these findings. White Americans are more punitive than people of color. Whites misjudge how much crime is committed by African Americans and Latinos. Racial perceptions of crime have distorted the criminal justice system, and racial perceptions of crime have undermined public safety. This Humanities Washington Think and Drink conversation touches on issues of implicit and explicit bias, police profiling, brutality, education and training, and what effective policing looks like. It's part of their ongoing series, Race, Place, and Culture. The panel includes Megan Ming Francis, an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Washington, and author of Civil Rights and the Making of the Modern American State. Seattle Police Department Assistant Chief Robert Murner, commander of criminal investigations, and SPD Sergeant Sean Whitcomb, public affairs director. Northwest News Network managing editor Phyllis Fletcher moderated the conversation. This event took place at Naked City Brewery and Tap House on October 27, 2015. Thanks to Brian Miller and Zeki Barak Hamid for their assistance, and to Anna Tadashev for our recording.
So my name is Bob Murner. If you can't tell by the accent already, I've spent the first 56 years of my life in Boston. I've been here since April. I'm the assistant chief for the Seattle Police Department. I'm in charge of investigations. I spent 34 years in law enforcement prior to coming to Seattle, 4 years working in the maximum security prison, 30 years working in Boston. I left Boston as the chief of detectives, which is pretty much the same job I have here. I've participated in thousands of investigations. I've worked with community groups, and I've, you know, got some decent stories to tell about things that we did in Boston as dealing with not only crime but race relations and some alternative programs to deter crime and some of the things that that we did there. Thank you for having me. I have to say, no one in Boston will believe that I'm doing a community meeting in a liquor establishment because this would go over very, very well there.
Thanks, Bob, for doing it. Okay, and Megan.
Hey, my name is Megan Francis. I'm a professor at the University of Washington in the Department of Political Science. My areas of specialty are American politics and constitutional law. I also do a lot of political history, early 20th century. Before that, born and raised in this town, left. Yeah, I know, right? Yeah. I went to Tops, and then I went to Garfield High School.
Yeah. All right, me
there
too.
There we go.
That's great.
And then I did my graduate work at Princeton, and I got a master's and a PhD in political science. After that, I was at Pepperdine for 4 years as a professor, and I have now been here for 2 years. So I'm really excited about this whole kind of conversation and discussion and excited that so many people came out.
Thanks, Megan. All right, Sean.
Hi, my name is Sean Whitcomb. I currently work in public affairs at the Seattle Police Department, and I'm a 20-year veteran of the Seattle Police Department, a UW grad. My favorite job on SPD was working as the drug court liaison to King County Adult and Juvenile Drug Court programs. Great program. We'll probably talk about it a little bit tonight. And any Destiny players out there?
Destiny? Is that a game?
So my...
Okay, we got one guy.
My achievement for this summer, I climbed Mount Rainier, and I beat Skolas in the Prison of Elders.
What? Okay, Destiny. All right, I'm going to have to find out about that. Okay, cool. All right, and I like to come around and Donahue it with you guys. I like to get you guys involved in the conversation as early as possible. And so we'll start by doing just kind of show of hands type of thing. So who has had an interaction with police that you think would have gone differently if you had been a different race? Okay. Most people. All right. Who has had an interaction with police? This is for people of color. That you think would have gone better if you had been white? Just a couple people, all right. Who has had a friend who has experienced either of those things that you think? Okay. And who has seen something, either of those things, unfold in person? Okay. Helpful. And so I want to turn to our great panelists here and ask, what is the last uncomfortable conversation you had with someone about the relationship between police and people of color? An uncomfortable conversation, it doesn't mean the other person was wrong, it doesn't mean you were wrong, but it was uncomfortable and it was memorable for you.
You want me to start?
Sure, yeah.
All right, So I was in New York about 2 weeks ago, and I got a text from my partner that he got stopped and profiled by SPD. So I was like, this is the second time this has happened, right? And so I come back to town, and I'm texting him, like, there's, like, nothing that I can do. And I dragged him here from New York, right? And he's like, now I've actually been stopped more times than people get stopped in New York by NYPD, right? So I'm like, oh, like, my wonderful liberal city, what in the world is going on? So I get back and we have a conversation about what happened. He is going to the movies. He is like driving on Bourne in Capitol Hill. And then a police officer sees him and then follows him, continues to follow him, stops him and then says, do you know why I'm stopping you? And he was like, we've done this before, right? So he's like, I don't know why, officer. And the officer tells him that he has a broken taillight and then wants to see his registration, wants to see his ID, right? But the problem, of course, was that there was not a broken taillight, right? So what this is, there's actually a recent book that I like a lot. It's called Pulled Over by Charles Epp, and it documents police stops in particular around Kansas City. And so he argues that there's two different types of kind of investigative stops, especially when one kind of stops an individual in their car. So one says that kind of these egregious violations, right? So like DUIs, and I'm going like 30 over the speed limit, right? Like clear. And there's other ones that are seen as kind of investigative stops where one is stopped to try to find a crime, right? And so he hasn't changed his ID yet. So the officer was like, well, you need to hurry up and change your ID, right? So it's just, we talked about it and he was like, you know what? I just don't want to drive anymore for a little while because I just don't want to drive. And I was like, okay, so it's been me driving, and which is fine at some level, and it's not fine on a whole lot of other levels. So,
who has made a decision to not drive because of either something like this happening or fear of something like this happening? One person, okay. You might be the person in the story. I'm just guessing, okay? Okay. All right, just guessing. Just making a major assumption. Okay, all right. Okay, thanks for coming out. Okay, all right. So, gentlemen, memorable conversation you've had that was not comfortable about policing relations with people of color.
So in the past year, too numerous to count. So as a commander in the Boston Police Department, chief of detectives, I was also the commander of what they call the public order platoons, which is the folks that wear the black pajamas when there's a large protest, parade, any type of event that has a potential for public order. Always the frontline commander on the line, Black Lives Matter march for the Christmas tree event in Boston drew 11,000 marchers around the Boston Common. Not one violent event. Folks were inside, and it was kind of comical because, you know, police always think we're great with numbers. So if it says 3,000 people are coming, we say, well, that means 1,000. So it said 4,000 people are coming. We figured about 1,200. Everybody arrived by public transportation. And when we looked out from the top by the State House, by the Boston Common, the oldest public park in the United States of America, there was over 10,000 marchers. Not one violent incident. I was the communicator with Donisha Yancey, who was the head of Black Lives Matter in Boston. We kept lines of communication open. And it gets heated because there are folks that, regardless, much like folks that feel they're pulled over for driving while black, every police officer is a racist. Every police officer is a bigot. Every police officer beats people, shoots people, and et cetera. So you have to be able to maintain your composure, have an adult conversation with folks that really aren't dealing with facts, and still be able to maintain a crowd of some 10,000 people with 170 officers. So it's really a fine line. That conversation took place everywhere in the United States for the past year. And I think the biggest thing is, you know, we talk about breakdowns. I don't think there's a breakdown. I think there was a never was. Because if there are lines of communication that have been set up long before any of these events take place, and I know we can get into things like Ferguson and other topics, there was no one in that community that felt comfortable enough to call the police department. And there was no one in that police department that felt comfortable enough to talk to members of the community. And so that's not a breakdown. That's a never was.
Yeah, thank you for that. So when you were thinking of the uncomfortable conversations, were those uncomfortable conversations that you had with the gentleman you were just describing or uncomfortable conversations that you had with your colleagues?
So the Donisha Yancey is actually female. She's the head of Black Lives Matter Boston.
Oh,
but
okay.
At any given time throughout that entire year, there was numerous conversations and dialogue with individuals regarding race relations and the police.
Okay. And you mentioned people who feel that they're pulled over because of driving while black. Is this something that you believe actually happens?
Do I believe it happens? Yes. There's no question that it happens. Do I believe that it happens just on a regular basis? As a police commander and having done this for a long time, our job is to actually get police to go out and do their job every single day. And many of us that are bosses, I know there's probably a lot of other folks that supervise people and own companies and run companies. The idea is to get your employees to at least do what you want them to do. So I've always dealt with if everybody just did exactly what they were supposed to do, no matter what your company was, you'd be 50% better. I don't think police officers go out of their way to make themselves more work. That's the way I look at it. Do I think it happens? I'd be foolish to say that I didn't think it happened.
Okay. All right. So, Sean, memorable, uncomfortable conversation.
Well, for my job, I manage SPD social media. And as you can imagine, we have developed a good following over the course of years. And we've done that by being engaging, by being human, and by providing accessible information. We've been able to build a following of 135,000 plus followers on Twitter. So anytime there's an incident in Seattle or on the national front that involves race, we hear about it on Twitter. It's something that, you know, we'll try to engage in. But ultimately, these comments aren't lost on me. And they form more of an aggregate of public sentiment. And, you know, one thing that we noticed since last summer, you know, when you follow someone on Twitter, you don't have to follow them to get their information, right? It's more of an endorsement of support. And we could see the trajectory of our account, which was going way up. It just kind of did one of these things where it really plateaued. And we could see that nationally as well with the other top departments in the country. You know, just things that we track. And, you know, that speaks a lot to public trust and confidence in policing, and it shows that we have a lot of work to do, and I completely agree with the chief. It's not a question of breakdown. It's, you know, where do you start building that from scratch at that point? So for us, social media isn't just a communications tool. It's virtual policing. You've heard of community policing. We do that virtually across the internet, and we do try to engage with as many people as possible. It's very important to us, like tonight, where there's access with the police department, that we create it in a way where people are during the course of their day, where they spend time for leisure, where they like to connect. We want to connect with them there too. So, yeah, when there's a deficiency, like what we saw on the news this morning nationally with the school resource officer, we see it. We hear it.
So, Sean, I'm going to do my thing and say, what is an uncomfortable conversation you've had with someone past year or so or recently about the relationship between police and communities of color or people of color?
When we see an incident like that, and we have to admit that there are shortcomings in the profession, and despite our best intentions, despite the goodwill of the people who enter a public service field, knowing that people's trust and confidence in the department, ours and others, is shaken, knowing that they aren't comfortable calling us when they have a bona fide, genuine emergency, and that really hurts. And that's why we get into policing. We want to help people. We want to go out. We want to make bad things better. We want to, you know, restore order and peace and tranquility to a chaotic situation. And when people aren't comfortable calling us, and really we're public servants, and that's a huge deficiency. And we know that that's something that we need to address.
So the uncomfortable conversations you have, are they mostly with police or non-police?
Non-police, members of the public.
Okay, how are your conversations with colleagues around this stuff? Like, is part of your job checking people?
You know, it's been years since I've been a frontline supervisor. But ultimately, whether you're a frontline supervisor or you're managing the department's Twitter account, I know these are conversations you have to have. You have to be aware of the deficiencies. You have to be aware that the department is made up of people, and that with the amount of contacts we have in our city, in a department our size, mathematically, you do know that things are going to go wrong. And it's one of those things where when things do go wrong, and it can range from rudeness to a questionable stop, to an illegal stop, to a fatality shooting, which we saw back in 2010. And it's not whether or not it's going to happen, it's how the department deals with it, and how much trust and confidence the community has that it's going to be dealt with appropriately and equitably.
What is something you would like to learn tonight?
You know, I just want to be part of the conversation, and I want to listen, and I want to take something away. So okay. I've got an open mind.
All right, great. Bob?
What's something you would like to learn? One of the things that I think you need to learn is what the community expects, what the community wants, and who the community is. So in policing, and I've done this, again, and it just means that I'm older than most cops, but I remember going to a triple shooting in a neighborhood, particularly violent neighborhood, home invasion, triple shooting, and that night was a community meeting at the public library in that particular neighborhood. And so I buffed up on everything. I was the lieutenant detective. I was the commander of detectives in that division. I was ready to talk about everything that we had to do, and this was drug dealers on drug dealers. This was not, you know, and granted, everybody's an innocent party, but this was drug dealers on drug dealers. I get into the meeting to talk about what we were doing with narcotics, what we were doing with this particular investigation. I was ready to go, and the community came into the meeting, as they did every Wednesday, and they said, you know what, Lieutenant, they're speeding, they're driving down this street, 50, 60 miles an hour. It's a residential neighborhood. When I go into the dry cleaners, there's people hanging on the corner. They're swearing. They're drinking. Nobody mentioned the incident that I did all my homework on. So that was some years ago, mid-90s, and I learned pretty quickly then that what I thought was a problem in the community was not what the community thought was a problem. So The biggest thing for me, being new here to Seattle, and I've only been here since April, is to learn what the community thinks the problem is, how they think their police are, and to enlighten the community as well as to things that we are doing now and things that we can do better.
And Megan, how about you? What's something you would like to learn tonight?
So I'm always curious, especially when there's officers around, about kind of standards of reasonableness. And this is something that I talk a lot about in civil liberties. In my civil liberties, I'm currently teaching a civil liberties seminar right now. And I did not plan it this way, but last week we did historical criminal procedure, so how we got to like Gideon, how we got to Miranda v. Arizona. And then this coming week, we're talking about kind of contemporary issues around policing. And so stops on the street, stops in your car, searches of one's home, as well as a number of the incidents kind of around solitary confinement. But what's seemingly always circulating, especially around a number of these high-profile incidents, is how do we understand what is reasonable, right? And so this is kind of one of the fun and totally problematic areas in terms of the Supreme Court. So can I just say something really quick about
yes.
two cases?
Yes.
And so one of the big cases in terms of that, what many people argued, lowered the bar in terms of when somebody is stopped and searched on the street is going to be Terry v. Ohio. And so they're often called, if you watch like some cop movies, Terry stops. And so kind of the bar in Terry is that kind of there has to be reasonable suspicion of the officer in order to stop somebody. And there has to be reasonable suspicion if a search is then conducted, right? But what is reasonable to me is likely different than what is reasonable to these two gentlemen who I'm sitting between, which perhaps might be kind of different standards of reasonableness for you, right? And so how do we justify a stop of an individual? Does it mean I think somebody's kind of shady, right? If they have long hair, or could it be that I think somebody's shady if they have tattoos, or is it about a color, or is it about baggy pants and the concealment of a weapon? But what exactly makes somebody suspicious? The same thing in terms of the car is going to be a newer case. Wren v. United States decided in 1996 by the court. And this is kind of that any traffic stop provides kind of reasonable basis, right? So it's not that matter of that. I mean, this is this amazing case in which the story is told that these two men were in a high drug traffic area, and then they like ran past a stop sign. And then the police just rolled on up, and there's like they just had bags of cocaine that they were like, here, officer, which we know like probably did not happen, right? There's probably a little bit of a process, right? So, but you know, but it goes to kind of when is it reasonable? Is it that I go 1 mile over the speed limit then becomes reasonable, right? That I don't do a full stop. So I'm always super curious, right? And so the whole case about Tamir Rice, and so for those who don't know, he was a young boy, 12 years old, who was playing with a toy gun outside of a rec center, and he was shot and killed by the police. And so there's two different studies that were done, I think, last week, and both of the studies concluded that it was reasonable for the officers to have fired shots at the young boy. Right. So, but the question here is, though, I mean, but all of this in terms of their standards here all turn on what is reasonable. And so that is always a huge question of mine. And so I think that's one of my big things to figure out. And I'm just curious about how people in Seattle, you know, think about policing and race. And all that
yeah, I'm going to get to you guys. So when you have something you want to ask or say, raise your hand. I see Bob's ready to talk. So while Bob talks, I'm going to walk to someone who has their hand raised. I see a lady right back there. So you probably have to meet me halfway because this microphone has a cable. Thank you.
So I just want to mention on the reasonableness, and I'm sure the people in the room know. So Terry v. Ohio was what's reasonable, and reasonable is the reasonable man theory, which the reasonable man, and it's unisex, is everybody in this room. So it's, and that's what it comes under. But there's three theories under reasonableness, that the person has committed a crime, is committing a crime, or is about to commit a crime. And for those of you that don't know Terry v. Ohio, it was a seasoned police officer in 1968 in Cleveland. And to tell you how long ago it was, it was an American Airlines storefront, and there wasn't credit cards. So when you went to buy plane tickets, or there wasn't a whole lot of credit cards, at least folks like us didn't have them, and you went in to buy plane tickets, you went in and you paid in cash. So there were three individuals outside of this American Airlines. Police officer was not surveilling them or anything, but he's seen them numerous times walk up to the window, look in the window, come back, talk two of them talking to each other, one in a car, and one of them was patting his side in a manner that the officer, when he confronted them, there was three individuals, one officer, and he decided to pat down their outer clothing for the mere presence of weapons only. It's not a search, it's a pat frisk. And so what he did was, it went all the way to the Supreme Court. One of the things that never comes out in the case, which is ironic, because I actually have the original police report from it, but in Terry v. Ohio, two of the three individuals were African-American. And most police officers that have used this for my 35 years in policing have talked about it. Very few realize that two of the individuals were African-American. Race was not a factor in this. These guys were going to rob the American Airlines office. And the court decided that it was reasonable that this officer, based on his training and experience, and I think that is a big thing that folks want to leave out, because I know when I hire a plumber and I bring him in to fix the furnace, and he says to me, you know, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do this, 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 and this, and it's going to cost you $1,000. I say, okay, geez, can we do it for $800? Because all the other things that he said, I don't know. But I'm depending on his training and experience to fix my boiler. And when we have police officers that have 5, 10, 20, 30 years of experience of doing police work, their concept of what's reasonable based on their training and their experience is different than the average citizens. No different than a plumber, than a finished carpenter, that we tell them how to do their job. That does not mean in any manner that I don't think people should give suggestions to the police or people should question police. 20, 30 years ago, nobody questions a doctor. And, I know my mother worked in a hospital for 30 years, and she always used to say, well, he's the doctor, so don't ask him any questions. Now I don't think there's anybody that goes to the doctor. Police should be questioned, but I also think they should be respected for their training and their experience of 10, 20, 30 years, that they have a different view of things than the average citizen, much like a plumber or an electrician has a different view of when they come to your house and start writing those bills out for you. So she hit it right on the head. I think it's reasonable to expect that you can walk the streets and be unaccosted. I think it's reasonable to expect that you should be safe in your motor vehicle. And by the way, I've been in the academy for the last 2 weeks getting Washington law converted to Massachusetts law. So in Washington, that federal law doesn't count. The police cannot search your car in Washington. You have more protections, much like we had in Massachusetts. You have more protections than the rest of America. So the state of Washington clearly gets individual freedoms right. So they can't go into your car.
Thank you.
That's C-A-R.
Car, right. Right. Okay, I see Megan's ready, but I do want to get to our first audience member, right? So what's your name, ma'am?
Mandy. My name's Mandy. Before my question, I want to say that I'm kind of happy with the new police chief. I like what I see coming out of Boston, and maybe you're a part of her team. So I'm happy with that. But I have two questions. I'd like to know if the police are required or if they can be required to take the Harvard implicit bias test. Because I think police especially suffer from, because of their job and their perspective, they have a certain bias that they carry with them that informs their job. And it's not always a positive thing. So I think they should be required to take the implicit bias test, and we all would benefit from it, but police especially. And I would also like to know if they are tested for steroids, because we have some really great cops, but we have a lot of cops that exhibit a kind of behavior that looks like, to me, like, you know, it might be steroid influenced, because it's just so aggressive. And I don't know what that's about, but I've seen it with my own eyes. So I want to see that addressed in the future.
Does the Guild allow for either of those tests to be required, a steroid test and the Harvard implicit bias test?
So there's drug testing when you come on, and then there's probable cause testing for drugs if you think somebody is using drugs or alcohol.
Including steroids?
Including steroids, yep. And I can tell you that for the implicit bias, if you look up the original panel, I was one of the original panelists with Professor Ogletree. We did it at the United States Federal Court in the city of Boston on implicit bias. And But it's not only implicit bias with race, it's the biases that we carry relative to everything is just amazing. There is some implicit bias training that we're doing, and Sean can talk about that a little bit, but I really think you have to go all the way to look at all the biases that we all have about things that we didn't even realize that we had.
Thank you. So, Sean, what would be the reaction if you went to your colleagues and said, hey, I just want you to take this test, or we're going to go ahead and make you take this test, the implicit bias test from Harvard?
Well, just a disclaimer, I'm not on the SPOG board, but right. I can predict with some degree of confidence that they would say they're open to it, they'd like to bargain. So, just saying. And as far as the training goes, I attended it last year on the... it wasn't called implicit bias training. There was no test. But we had a very open conversation about bias, inherent bias that we all carry along with us. We talked about it in a classroom setting. A member of the Community Police Commission was there. And it's just this understanding and recognition that as humans, we do have bias. It doesn't mean that we're bad people, that we're malicious or evil or racist. But it is something that we need to be aware of, based on our upbringing, based on our life experiences. So as we go out into the world and we're carrying the authority of the law and we're being asked to enforce the law and at times deprive people of their civil liberties, that we are aware of these biases that we carry and to ensure that we treat people fairly and equitably.
And on the real tip, like, what would be the reaction if you said that? In a meeting right
that's,
before people
want to that's it. I mean, straight up, that's exactly what you'd hear. Let's do it. Let's talk about it. Needs to be bargained.
Everyone, they would say, okay, but.
Okay, but.
All right.
Not necessarily. I mean, we have training now that you would never see 20, 30 years ago in any myriad of subjects, race. In Boston and in Seattle, we have... members of the community coming in, talking about, cultural competency and things like that. That didn't happen in policing 20, 30 years ago. So, to say that it would be implicit bias would be, yeah, but I don't believe that because we're doing things in policing nowadays that 20, 30, and I can only go back 35 years, but would be unheard of, would be totally unheard of. It was, push-ups, defensive tactics, criminal law, criminal procedure, and then go out in the street and do your job. So clearly there's that, I'm not saying they would say, oh, sure, we'll try that. But I don't think it would be yes, but, because a lot of those things are taking place now.
I want to make sure that I'm not being biased by only getting to people who are within a few feet of me. So be sure if you have something you want to say or ask, raise your hand, step halfway up since I'm limited by the length of my cable here. And I'll go next to this gal right here. What's your name, ma'am?
My name's Denise, and I hear the concern that perhaps there are people in the community who feel that all police officers are this way, and I'm wondering how you feel the proverbial blue shield of the good officers who cover for the bad officers contributes to that, and what can be done to help the whole force become more representative of what the force is as a whole. The problem is when you defend the worst offenders, you all become tainted by it. So what is the plan to do something about that?
So first off, I can tell you that, I before being in management, I worked in the union, in the detectives union, in the Superior Detectives Union in Boston. And one of the arguments that I always made is we spent 90% of our money on 1% to 2% of our membership. And I think that happens in every union in the country. So clearly, officers are tired of that. And quite frankly, I've talked about the conversations that have gone on, the uncomfortable conversations that have gone on for over a year now. I don't think they're uncomfortable. I think they're necessary. But the officers are tired of being painted with that brush. So, and all I can say is this. Did anybody see a bad incident happen in Seattle Police Department here today? Does anybody know of a bad incident? Do you know how many calls the Seattle Police Department handled today? They handle 60,000 Part 1 calls a year. 60,000 Part 1. Those are just your big crimes. So, you know, when we look at those things, those offices that are handling 60,000 Part 1 crimes a year, whether it's in Seattle, whether it's in Boston, whether it's in St. Louis, do not want to be painted with the brush of that one officer. So the fact that this Blue Shield and that they're covering for him, I don't see that happening anymore. As a matter of fact, I just read an article before I left. I still, you know, I read the Seattle Times, I read the Boston Globe, on what's going on in Rutland, Vermont, relative to racial profiling there. And it was police officers that testified, both black and white officers that testified, and brought it to the attention of their commanders. So it's happening. Police officers are tired of being painted with that brush, and I don't see that that's the case. Quite frankly, here in Seattle, some of the training that we have, some of the stuff that was a result of the settlement agreement, is that officers are reporting that at a rate like I've never seen in my 35 years.
So we have another audience member here. Here.
Yeah, sure. My name's Annie, I have a lot of thoughts and questions, but I'll try and keep it as concise as possible. One thing you mentioned was public kind of having a respect for police officers and their experience, or their 30 years of experience. But then you also mentioned that 10, 20, 30 years ago, you didn't have the training that you have today. So it makes me wonder, you know, what... I guess the context of the experience of these officers, and then how that will play a part in the way that they're addressing issues. But then I guess also I'm wondering about the thorough diversity of the police force. So how many people grew up in specific communities that they are policing or are live there now, or how that works. I'm also new to Seattle, so I don't know exactly how I'm from a small town, so it's like completely different game. But yeah, so I guess that those are my main questions at the moment.
Thank you.
Can I two-finger that real quick?
Sure.
So when you had finished, there was a lot that I wanted to say. So one, right, I think that policing is very different than plumbing, right, because we're dealing with like real people. And I think that's something important. I think it's one thing to say that I've been a professor for 20 years, and so my experience should speak for how well I operate in the classroom, right? But I get at some level that one's experience on a job can matter, but professors mess up all the time, egregious mess ups, right? In the same way that I don't think 20 years as a professor at University of Washington, I have not been teaching for 20 years, right? But in the same way that I don't think 20 years should provide a shield to one in terms of really deep questioning, in the same way that I don't think that 15, 20, 30 years on the force should shield one from very deep questioning, especially when we're at a time like we are right now. And then I think in terms of, because I do historical stuff, so a little bit about what you were saying here. So if we know that kind of history influences the present, and we know that policing operated in a particular way around black bodies and bodies of color, well then, police officers who were policing 20 and 30 years ago, are they bringing some of these biases into the current way that they're also policing and operating and or not? And then I think also connected to that, if I could, I just added two questions onto your three questions.
Great.
But like, what is being done to this? Or do we just have seasoned officers who operate from a perspective of race and policing from 20 years ago?
Great.
So I can probably answer a couple of those, two and then three. But I can just say this. So I'll give you an example of 1990 in Boston. I was part of the gang unit, which we worked in the predominantly minority section of the city. We were taking more guns off the street. We were arresting more people for narcotics. We were putting more people in jail based on some of the mandatory drug sentences. And this was the kind of the mid-range of the crack epidemic that hit every major city in the United States. We had 152 homicides in 1990 in Boston. We were the gang officers. We had, at that time, some of the guys had 15, anywhere between 5 and 20 years on the job. And we turned around and we said, this isn't working. These were offices that were working in the minority community, 90%. And if Councilor Tito Jackson in Boston was here now, he would say, Bob, Boston's 51% persons of color now, so it's no longer can be referred to as the minority community. So what we did was we turned around and we started looking for things, and Ted Kennedy came to do a ride-along with us, and, you know, the federal money was flowing into the war on drugs, gang initiatives, the great program, all of these things. And he rode along with three of us, and he said, what do we need? And he expected the response to be, we need, you know, more bulletproof vests, we need better cars, we need helicopters, we need new firearms. We said, look it. We need some mentoring programs for these kids. We need some jobs. We need to be able to get these kids back on track. And we have to start tracking them families. We have to start tracking the families. Because the kids that were gang involved, the families were receiving numerous other social service resources, not in a bad way, but nobody was countering what was going on in that home. So we were looking at the 16 or 17-year-old gang member who was out slinging crack on the corner. But he was the same kid that was inside the house putting breakfast on the table and making sure the younger siblings were getting to school because that's what was going on in the home. So we looked at it that way. We started working with alternative sentencing, working with probation because probation worked from 9 in the morning until 5, Monday through Friday. So we had kids that were on curfews, that were out doing their business, and nobody was checking on them. First of all, there was no way to check on them because the court was closed. Second of all, many of these kids, and this was, again, I'm dating myself a little bit for some of the folks in the room, but not everybody had a cell phone. Not everybody had a house phone in this neighborhood. So these kids were out there. If they were out, they were victimizing. If they were out, they were being victimized. So we started taking some initiatives. The other thing that was going on was kids that got involved in violence and narcotics were expelled from school. But at the same time, we had a mayor of the city that was saying, wait a minute, why are all these kids roaming the streets? And we went to the school committee, and they said, no, he's been expelled for an act of violence. So we have one part of the government in the city saying they have to be out of school, and the other part of the government in the city saying, why are all these school-age kids roaming the streets? We took an approach to that, and by 1995, we had gone from 152 homicides in the city of Boston to 33, and no one under the age of 17 was killed for 2.5 years. Those programs took off nationally. Chief O'Toole was part of that. It's part of the concept that we're using here. We're working with the community groups, but part of that is we said to the kids that were hardcore gangbangers, we need you out of the gang. And they look you right in the eye and say, okay, now what, Bob? Now what? So you have to be able to get them back into school if they're high school age. You have to be able to get them some type of mentoring. They were looking at all the ivory towers, much like we have here in Seattle. They were looking at all the glass towers. It was within a stone's throw from where they sat, from where they lived, from where they were dodging bullets and dodging violence every day. And there was might as well have been a million miles away. And that happens in every major city in the United States. So we got to call on all of us, our business partners and everybody else, to get involved in taking some of these kids back in. It's about saving lives. It's not about putting people in jail.
We have another audience member here.
Hi, my name's Sandy. I'm a Seattle resident forever. And I realized as I was listening to you, Mr. Muir, that you are indeed very, very recently here. No one here would say they were calling a plumber to fix a furnace. And for a minute I thought you were having a moment. I know it's a boiler, but we generally don't use that language here, and that led me to think more about language in general and about the specifics of the community. Because to a certain extent, how we express ourselves to each other tells the person we're talking to what we think about them. Even if we're not saying specifically, I think you're this, I look at you and I see that, our general, just the penumbra of what we do and say is as expressive as any one particular message. And this is, again, this is jumping back just a little bit to the idea of reasonableness and community. We're rapidly becoming a very divided city because we have an incredible amount of wealth that's becoming concentrated in particular neighborhoods, particular jobs, And then we have people who cannot find a way to get in to the economy. I wonder what we can do in terms of relating to different communities and how we as individuals walking around and how you as representatives of you, the bookend guys here, as representatives of, you are actually, I hate to say this, civil servants. How can we help people?
You shouldn't hate to say that.
Well, it implies all kinds of stuff. Again, it's about language. I can't help it. I write. So how can we learn to see the people that are in front of us, not the idea of some, some like, statistically averaged person that we think we know? How can we learn to see the people that are in front of us and deal with the people that are in front of us? That, I think, is probably the biggest challenge we all face.
So just to get back to that example, I talked about probation. So my goal as a gang officer, when I was going into a home where a kid was supposed to be home by 9 o'clock, wasn't supposed to be on a certain corner, wasn't supposed to be associating with certain individuals, my intention when I went there is, good, he's not going to be home. He's going to be out. I'm going to be able to get him a violation, and he's going to go to jail. What I got was into the home and seeing that person differently, seeing that 17-year-old who was doing different things in the home, seeing many times a single mother or a maternal grandmother in the home saying, oh, my God, I've been looking for somebody that I could call. This is what I'm looking for. So now this 17, 18-year-old gangbanger that I thought was, one of the dregs of society, I got a whole new perspective, which is, I think, exactly what you're talking about. We were able to plug in, and I'm talking hundreds of these kids. The program that we started was called Summer of Opportunity. It's in its 25th year. It was a summer jobs program. It's now year-round. And we pulled in John Hancock and Northeastern University. We have all of the same institutions here in Seattle. We pulled in the Brigham and Women's Hospital. You got all of these educational institutions, medical institutions, financial institutions in Boston, much like you had here, and we put the arm on them. And we sent kids to job. These were kids that could run down crack deals all day long, but didn't know how to wash or answer a phone or dress for an interview or talk to another adult like we're having a conversation now. It starts small, and then you make it bigger.
You have a follow-up?
I want to hear more of what they have to say.
Okay, all right. Okay, we'll leave it there. Okay, thank you. Thank you. And we have a gentleman right here who's ready. Okay. And sir?
Hi, I have just two questions. So the first question is, when does education or the relationship with children and individuals start, and how is it delivered at schools or wherever? Because I think like the more exposure at a younger age could lend to know what are the expectations when dealing with police. And the second question is, what are the backgrounds of most police officers? Do they have four-year degrees, graduate degrees? And I ask that because I look at my friends that I'm sitting with, and most of us are African-American who have graduate school degrees, live in top-income societies, and have been around the world. So my view of reasonableness and my view of what is reality might be very different than everyone else's, while I also have been arrested twice. So I just wonder how that fits, and I wonder the same for the police officers, because I wonder if most of them have the same qualifications or backgrounds that I do.
Thank you. So qualifications first. Let's talk about that.
So real quick, because this actually builds on a couple of other questions that had been previously asked, and I don't have the latest metrics committed to memory. I do know, I think it was the Washington Post had run a story on it, post-Ferguson, what do police departments look like who are serving in America, and the Seattle Police Department is actually, from a diversity standpoint, very representative of the city of Seattle, and I know that the candidates that we have, and yes, we are hiring in a very fiercely competitive police market, some of the best candidates that there are. We have a lot of four-year degrees and higher. I know on my team, one of the people I just supervised just last year had a master's degree in public administration. One of the women I supervise currently has a master's degree and digital communication. You know, I feel lowly here with my four-year degree, but granted, it's from UW, so it counts for more. And also, as far as where people live, I mean, people make choices. There's no incentive to live in Seattle. So there's, you know, whatever works for most. When I was patrolling Green Lake, like 2 miles from here, I lived in my beat, and I loved it, and I would not have had it any other way. On my break, I could go home and have a bowl of cereal. It was amazing. You know, if I thought I left the stove on, I could check, because I'm that guy. But, you know, you feel connected when you are working in your area where you're serving. I mean, yeah, I see it a little differently, but plus, people would make fun of me because I had like a 1 mile commute to the precinct. So, Seattle's a very diverse city. There's a very fiercely competitive process. It is normal to expect officers to have 4-year degrees, and if they don't have 4-year degrees, to have a very rich life experience and other employment experience coming into the job.
And I wanted to just bring it back also to the first question, just so that doesn't get forgotten, which was about children. And you were asking about, yeah, come right on back so we can make sure we get it right. Let me not paraphrase it. Go ahead and ask.
And to that first point, I really mean more of the frontline police, because like you were talking about, you're more in the office and working on the, you know, social media team. So I expect most people to have communications degrees. But I'm wondering if the frontline police officers, and when you said they have a host of life experiences, what does that mean? Like, what does it mean for that? Like, what is the average GPA in school? And those things that many of us and a lot of other things get measured on.
So I can just answer, again, speaking from experience of many years. When I came on, 30-odd years ago, police officers, most of them were post-military high school diploma. That's changed drastically, and I can speak for myself. Just to talk briefly about background, I grew up in Roxbury, section of Boston. So when I was a kid, Roxbury was about 95% African-American. I was one of the 5%, if you didn't see. Mission Hill Housing Development, which is most famous for the Charles Stewart case, which was another one of these racially biased cases. White man murders his pregnant wife and then says it was the, you know, unknown black male did it. So I was a police officer when that happened. But, as a result of that, I grew up, I started in Roxbury, son of an iron worker and a hospital secretary. I've been to work my way through Bunker Hill Community College, Western New England College, got my master's at BU, went to the FBI Academy, worked on my second master's to the University of Virginia, and then I went back and taught at Bunker Hill Community College for 8 semesters. This job has taken me everywhere in this country and to England, to Dubai, to other places, talking about different things. Policing now is no longer something that's a local kid with a high school diploma jumping on the job. Well, these kids are highly educated. My biggest problem with some of the young officers that come on with great degrees and phenomenal GPAs is they have a hard time having a conversation without going like this. And I'm not kidding. As a matter of fact, I've been at the academy for the last 2 weeks. The recruits from all over this region are phenomenal. It's very competitive, very competitive. But one of the things that when we went through the police academy was when a seasoned officer or a superior officer came, much like anybody that's been in the military, you turned and faced a wall or you locked it up and you just let them pass, you saluted. They're forcing these kids to engage and talk to folks because they have these phenomenal degrees. They have great life experience. They're from all over the country coming here to this northwest region. But they don't know how to have a conversation.
Well, let me just do a really quick lightning round on this. So in a city in Seattle or a major metropolitan area, can you become a police officer if you have not graduated high school?
No.
Can you become an officer if you have only graduated high school?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Is there a GPA requirement if you only have a high school diploma?
No.
No. Okay. All right. And so... I wanted to make sure we don't forget your original question, which was about children. Yeah, so specifically, what are you after as far as information about about how what children learn from or about police.
Well, that's what I would like to know. Like, when does it start? How is there programs at elementary school levels and then in middle school levels? How is it delivered?
So I'm going to try to address this. So at different levels there is, but I'm going to try to slightly also kind of turn the question, right? So in conversations around policing and race, there's kind of two different ways in which one could look at it, right? One frame that says we need to prepare people better, right? That people should know their rights. They should be more informed and part of kind of the civic process. The other side of the argument is that kind of there's a big system-wide problem, right? So one argument also says that we should kind of educate, especially kind of students of color, about how to interact with the police. Another school of thought says that we actually should educate and work with police officers so students of color do not have tense interactions with police. And so, by my tone, it's clear that I'm on the latter side, right? So at some level, I think that it's... I think it's incredibly problematic to say that what we should do is to teach students in elementary, middle, and high school how to interact with the police. But there's a whole other thing to be said in terms of, right, kind of social studies and learning the law. I think that's perfectly fine. In terms of that, I think it ranges. I mean, students in my class, I often had, you know, in California and here, freshmen and sophomores, and so it's often... kind of what did they learn and when did they learn it. Most of my students kind of opted into a class in high school where they learned a little bit about the law, they learned a little bit about their rights, and that's about it. But I don't think the training is that deep for most students, even at the college level. I've had seniors in my class like, oh, for real? Like, somebody actually has to have a warrant to search my place if I don't invite them in, right? I'm like, unless you have, like, coke and weed on the table with the blinds open, right? Like, yeah. But they don't know these things. And in part, I think, you know, I think a lot of the questions today and the ones that circulate in my mind go to how should we understand this problem? I think a lot of people in this room would like to understand what I think is an obvious crisis in race and policing right now, which is why we're having this discussion, and I'm so glad we're having it. But is this kind of an individual problem, right? I call this the bad apple problem, right? Is there a few bad apples? Was Darren Wilson a bad apple? Was kind of the police officers who got in the chokehold, Eric Garner, were they kind of bad apples? Was the police officer that shot Tamir Rice? Was the school person, right? And kind of this crazy incident that happened with this young girl, right? Was he just a bad apple? Do we just have a bunch of bad apples, or do we have a whole system-wide problem where we actually need to, like, grow the tree in a different way and or cut the damn tree down, right? But, like, I'm not sure. I think in this room, some people think it's a system-wide institutional problem, that it's not that we have bad apples, that we have rules and regulations that allow people's racial bias to come out in particular ways. The other argument is that there's a lot of really, really good people. I believe these two people are really great standing next to me, even though I kind of have slight bias around Boston. Right? I live in Roxbury, though, so I like
that.
I like
probably
Boston.
Has something to do with football.
That's fair. Oh, you're not winning fans right now.
I'm only kidding.
But, like, I mean, so I, there's clearly, right, like, but I, and I think that's kind of the complicated thing in terms of, because I think at the base of all this stuff is how do we fix this, right? And that goes to how do we understand the problem. So
can I just answer just one thing? And again, going back to 25, 30 years of policing, and we talk about 4, 5, 6, a half dozen incidents and bad apples. So for 30 years, I've watched police officers in Boston, but I know it goes on in every city in the United States. I've watched police officers put milk in refrigerators. And I'm watching what I say because I got that furnace boiler thing going.
I've
watched police officers put food in cabinets. I've watched police officers carry stuffed animals in their car, tend to people at domestic violence calls, drop off Christmas presents. But you know what? CNN isn't there. MSNBC isn't there. And I've watched this hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of times a day. A year, over 35 years. That's in one city. So I'm not saying that the police officer that choked out Eric Garner and killed him did the right thing. I don't think there's a police officer in this country that watched the South Carolina police officer shoot someone running from him 8 times in the back said, oh, yeah, that was a great job. It didn't happen. We were horrified by it. We were sickened by it. And we were painted by it. I've chased thousands of police, perpetrators in 35 years. Never once did I think of shooting someone in the back 8 times. I have a son that's a police officer who's also got a graduate degree, and much to my chagrin, he went to an East Coast undergrad school that I paid for. He went to graduate school that I paid for, and then he came to me one day and said, Dad, I'd like to be a policeman. I said, you should have told me that about $250,000 ago. But I agree with you. I think that is a bad apple problem, and I think police officers that are putting food in refrigerators, putting food in cabinets, tending to folks at Christmas time and things, that's not on the news, and well, people don't want to hear it.
All due respect, when that's the only story to tell, public radio will be there too. We have a question.
Okay, I'm not sure this is a question, and in light of all these huge issues and things we've been talking about, this is more personal. And I don't even know if it's a question, it's a wonder, and maybe Megan, you might. I have 2 friends, African American, who we invited to come tonight. They've been to Think and Drink before. And the woman, they're in their late 30s, early 40s, and she couldn't handle the idea of coming and dealing with this topic publicly. She had a recent incident at a concert, and the other young man, I didn't find out the exact reason why he didn't want to come, but I'm sure it's the same. And so I was thinking about the last Think and Drink we were here. There was a lot of white people, and same tonight. And I'm here because I feel it's my job as a white person to feel uncomfortable and try to grow. But I really feel sad that my friends aren't here and that they really felt unsafe, not because any of you people, wonderful people, would make them feel that way, but their experiences were so uncomfortable, and I'm sure it's one of many in their lives. And again, they're highly educated people, but I'm just wondering what we can do about, I don't know. I don't know what I'm wondering. I just wish they were here.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for saying that. We have a few black people in the house tonight. Can you relate to being like, I don't want to be here right now. It's not my job to be here right now. Anyone relate to that? You just wanted to be here. That's awesome. Great. Okay. I hear that. So, we have a gal here, and then I'm going to get to you and you. Okay. Yes.
I will have to say, hi, my name is Kubi. I will have to say I've had more negative incidences with people in the neighborhood than I have with actual officers. I usually have a good experience with officers. Even when I'm in the wrong and they have to correct me about something, I'm good. But I do have a son who is really pissed at police, and I want to curtail that, and I don't even know how to even school him on love, peace, and happiness, because that, I'm the major tree hugger here, and then my son is angry at police, and I don't really know what to do with that.
So I think 2 things, and I agree with my colleague, it's not just training young people how to deal with police. It's training the police how to deal with young people. So it's not, this isn't a one-way thing where, I think we can all agree, young people should be able to express themselves. We all did. And there's got to be a medium between how the police deal with young people as well. But I can talk to you offline, and we can, after this, and we can plug him in to some of the stuff that we're doing with young people.
And we have a question here.
If I can just add on to that just really quickly. I think, in terms of the last 2 comments, I think what's really big oftentimes is just to hear people and, not say that it's going to be okay, because sometimes it's not going to be okay. Sometimes it's not going to get better, right? And so, like, I have a brother that has horrible experiences with Philly police. And he lives in a so-called high-crime area in Philly. And then, like, and all the times when he calls me with these crazy stories about being handcuffed, about being pushed against a wall, I want to make it better. But you can't, and so you say things like, "Let me focus on school. Why don't you focus on school? Why don't you get out? Why don't you go see a movie?" And he's just like, "I don't want to hear that," because they're so mad, and they're justifiably sometimes mad. And so I think sometimes, at least with him, sometimes it's just like, "I just want you to hear me." And even if it's not your experience, Megan, like, I just want you to hear me and be with me in this moment. And I think sometimes that's helpful.
So I was just curious to hear what you guys had to say about how the war on drugs affected all of this. The new Jim Crow argued that the war on drugs regulated or, you know, treated people of color the same as Jim Crow did. So I just was curious to know what your effects on the policing and race, what that effects on of it, and if there could be any policy change that would, you know, make the difference in terms of the war on drugs.
So first off, it absolutely had a tremendous effect on it. If you looked at back in the late 80s and early 90s, an aggregate sale of 5 grams of crack cocaine would get you 10 years of a federal sentence. So that's 5 grams. So, again, using my Boston term, those were called jums. They were $10 bags of crack. They were called jums. You would buy 10 jums on 10 different occasions, and you could come up to 2.5 grams. So if you bought two each time, an 18, 19-year-old African-American in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, who got an aggregate sales of 5 grams of crack cocaine, would be looking at 10 years in the federal prison or 5 years in the state prison. So we were taking whole age groups completely out of the community. However, 5 grams of powdered cocaine, you were looking at, a house of correction sentence at most, which is usually, in Massachusetts, was less than a year in jail. So it clearly was this so-called war on drugs had a clear racial overtone and effect on the way that business was done. No doubt about it. Part of that was the violence that came with the, and again, not making excuses, because it was, and one of the things that's going on right now, I'm sure you're aware of, is that they're looking at all of these mandatory sentences from that period and working on, and police officers that I sit with every day say, that's ridiculous, all these folks are going to be getting out of jail. A lot of these folks should have been out of jail a long time ago. So there's no question about that. It was an answer to the violence that came with the crack epidemic. And, you know, besides the folks that went to jail, a whole lot of people are dead based on the violence that went with it. So many times you didn't have witnesses.
But do you think that the violence was caused by the illegalization to begin with?
I think the violence was caused at that when crack epidemic kind of hit in the mid-80s into the early 90s, there was a lot of money being made. That, you know, one corner was making $5,000-$10,000, you know, from 8 to noon, then another $5,000-$10,000. So there was a lot of money, but there was 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 corners going on every block. So there was a lot of money being made. The violence was as to the money aspect of it. Nowadays, the violence doesn't, you know, has nothing to do with folks making money. But clearly, that war on drugs had a horrific effect on a whole generation of African American kids in this country. And I know in the city of Boston, but I know it was nationwide.
Okay, we have Molly, and then I think we have these two gentlemen here, right? Is that right? Okay, all right. And then that might end up being what we got time for tonight in terms of questions. So just want to put that out there. If you think you want to try to crowbar one in really quick, just get with these guys really quick. Molly.
Hey, Megan, what's up? Megan was part of our ASB at Garfield in 1999. What's up, Bulldogs? Good job. So here's my question. It sort of takes it back to the community policing. I read something. I don't have a work cited for you, Megan. Sorry. After Ferguson, I read something about how most of the police that came in during the riots lived in suburbs, you know, way outside the city, and that was their usual beat, was, you know, they lived outside the city in the burbs, and they came in, and so they really had no community connection. And I've, like, to me, when I read that, I was like, that's the biggest problem. They're policing, but they don't care about these people. They don't know them. They're not their neighbors. So, like, how much is that something that's important? I guess you can't speak to, you know, police departments nationwide, but is that something that policemen or police departments are cognizant of?
Two things. Many of the agitators that caused all the problems in Ferguson's were not from the community. So that's already been borne out by a number of the studies. I'm talking about the problems. I'm not talking about the protest. I'm talking about folks that came in with destruction. I'm not talking about folks that were protesting. But you're absolutely, if there's a question,
I think the gentleman wants to know, were the officers, were any of the officers from Ferguson?
No, they pulled in officers from all the surrounding towns, what they call Metrolec, so small communities, much like here in Seattle. So if some of the smaller towns that have 20, 30, 40 person police departments, they don't have full-time SWAT teams, so they resource. But they weren't officers that police Ferguson on a daily basis. So they didn't have any ties to the community. But quite frankly, I don't think the Ferguson police themselves had great ties to the community. I think that's where it all began, and that makes a huge difference.
And do we have, and I want to invite some of these gentlemen to come forward also, do we right now have officers policing the CD who are from the CD, or officers policing Rainier Valley who are from Rainier Valley? Do we have that?
I mean, yeah, it's a good mix. I mean, ultimately, people are going to live where they want to live.
Do we have people who grew up in the CD policing the CD? Like, do you have, like, a poster child for that right now?
Yeah, I don't know if he's still working patrol, but we had a man who was a product of the Rainier Valley, worked in a barber shop, hired on, became a police officer, and then served in the same community. I mean, we've got countless stories of people who are raised in this city, raised in this area. You know, I'm from northern Washington State, grew up on Camano Island. But, you know, my grandparents, both sets, lived in Seattle. My mom and dad were raised in Seattle. So what? They moved out to the suburbs. I came back for college. I lived in the city. I patrolled the city. I love this city. I'm one of many, many people who patrolled the streets of Seattle, live in the community, shop in the community, are invested in the community. And ultimately, even if I wasn't, living in Seattle and working in Seattle, you have to have a deep love and understanding of the community. And when you have breakdowns, it's because people are not willing to take the time to communicate, to understand, to empathize. And some of the training that we have right now, I was lucky enough to have Timothy Williams from the New York Times come attend training with me this spring, where he learned how this department is leading the country in de-escalation. And de-escalation is more than a buzzword. It's actually more of a buzzword. And what it really boils down to is listening, taking the time and listening. I know we put on a uniform, we put on the vest, the gun belt, and we're authority figures. At the end of the day, we are civil servants. Our job is to keep the peace. We need to get into a situation and listen. A situation is already amped by the time we get there. We got to bring it down, find out what the problem is, come up with a solution, and leave people feeling a little bit better about what has definitely been a bad day and the reason they called us. So when we're talking about living in the city, knowing the city, identifying with the city, there is no, and yes, the Ferguson case, there's a huge disconnect, and I'll honestly say that. And there are some employees here who are not connected with the city. I will say that. I will say the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of the people who work here love the city and are connected to it. And you should expect nothing less.
Thank you, Molly. And Megan, I want to let you talk while I get this gentleman here.
Excellent. So I grew up in the South End, and I live in the city now. I don't see that many people who are policing, because there's police, they're very visible in the city, right? Like, especially post 10 p.m. And so I don't see a lot of people here from the community. I'm not convinced. I think it makes a difference if one knows the community. I'm not going to lie, though. I'm highly suspicious of community policing and of that term. I am. So I'm not convinced that just because one knows a community really well that things significantly improve. I think kind of the most obvious example, I think, I would easily point to Baltimore, in which a number of kind of the officers who we've been seeing brutalizing different individuals who were involved in what happened around Freddie Gray, they were actually from the community, right? And a number of the officers who've been accused of brutality are Black officers from a lot of the communities in which they are policing. So I'm not totally convinced that will improve relations. Again, I think it's a more kind of a systematic problem than just like, oh, we need some officers who just are from the CD to make things better. Like, that's just not going to make things better for me and my friends.
Hi, my name's Chris Cantrell. Previously, I think you touched on institutionalized racist beliefs. And it seems like there's really two things to be done. People that hold explicit racist beliefs should probably be let go from the police force. But the implicit tendencies probably are playing into the institutionalized racism you were touching on earlier. I think the education that's really been pushed here is definitely part of the solution. But from a political science perspective, tossing the ball to you, what would be, in a perfect world, what would be the judicial and legislative things you would change to deal with that?
That's a good one. That sounds like a lecture. Can you lightning round it for me?
I know. Oh my gosh, there's a number of things. Okay, so I would I think you're right. I think the kind of the second issue is the biggest problem, right? In terms of the ways in which implicit bias kind of play a role in terms of when one is policed, right? And I think sometimes it's done intentionally, sometimes less intentionally. So I often tell stories, right, in terms of, because I think the explicit is easy, right? It's right. We point to these so-called bad police officers and we say those people are bad and those people should be off the force. But then kind of the question is, when these people are off the force, do we get kind of this happy police force, right? And like highly improved relations with, let's say, communities of color. And I'm not convinced that happens, in part because of the second issue you raised. So in terms of how do we make that better, I think we pass laws in terms of to raise the accountability. So I mean, part of the reason why I raise this issue about reasonableness is that I think we need better standards. And so NYPD, I don't fully agree with this idea, but I think it's a step in the right direction. And so NYPD has kind of there was a lot of media attention, especially around their stop and frisk, right? They stopped in 2011, this is the big statistics, 9% of white individuals were stopped, 33% were Latino, and something like 54% of people who were stopped were African Americans, right? And then 12% of the cases, drugs or contraband was returned, and far lower percentage for Latino and African Americans. But what they're doing now, as a result of a number of federal lawsuits, is that they now have something, and I hate this word, they're calling them receipts. And so what happened before is, like, let's say that you were stopped and frisked. You were stopped and frisked in your housing development or just somewhere on the street, and then you had a bad experience, but you were let go because you had no drugs or contraband. Now what they're doing is it's a piece of paper that explains why you were stopped. Their reason for actually stopping you, and then like what happened in the course of that stop, right? And so what that does, I think, at some level, is it raises the bar. It's like, I just can't stop everybody that's kind of brown skin on the street that I could, because I'm going to be made to explain myself for that. So I think more things around that at some level rein in discretion, and that kind of push up against issues of reasonableness. But at the same time, and this is because I know we're winding down now, I do want to say, and I'm not letting police off the hook at all, but there's a larger issue, right? So we're like, it's police fault. Like, we have all this crazy racism. And, like, it is at some level, right? But there's, I think, a larger issues that we have in terms of race in the United States, where we have, like, you know, I've been with friends on both sides, Black men who, like, walk down a street and then, like, somebody clutches their purse, right? Because they're scared. And part of that suspicion, it like plays into sometimes how people make decisions. Police officers are clearly more dangerous because their decisions sometimes involve life or death, right? But I've been with other people, like Asian and women friends, who like walk quickly when they see a black man on a dimly lit street and then feel the need to quickly kind of explain themselves to me, which is like kind of a sad exchange. But this happens at a micro level in non-police forces, right? And so they make life, like, decisions every day about kind of life and death. And like, but there's this huge, I think, kind of wide array of discretion. But I do think that there's things that we can do. I like law, so I think more things like that would work out. In terms of legislation, I mean, there's a whole lot you could do. We could be here till tomorrow, and we can't be here till tomorrow.
Let's not do that.
So let me just say, on that form that she's talking, that the NYPD in their infinite wisdom has just come up with, Seattle Police has been using it for some time now, and Boston Police has been using it for about 30 years. So I'm glad the NYPD got with the rest of the country now.
So but I have an interaction, I can ask for a receipt?
It's not a receipt. It's called a Terry form, believe it or not. And we hate the word Terry, but that's what those stops are. They're Terry stops. So, but, you know, she's absolutely right. It's not just a policing issue. This is an issue that permeates society. The only thing I will say about being from the community, because, you know, the only thing I'll get defensive about is being new to Seattle up here.
Is that the only thing?
It's the only thing.
Okay.
Well, I won't talk about football.
Okay. right.
But, you know, it's funny because having grown up in the Boston Police Department for 30-plus years, I took it personal when people got robbed, when people's houses were broken into. And, you know, unfortunately, being the chief of detectives in two cities, every single thing that happens, I get. All night, 24 hours a day. So if there's a strong-arm robbery in the downtown section, if there's shots fired in the West Precinct, if there's some type of a malicious harassment incident in the East Precinct, I get it. And one of the things I was afraid of when I got here was that I wasn't going to take it as personal, because Boston was my home. I grew up there. I grew up in that police department, and I take it very personal when things happened. Well, I can tell you, and you know, I can only speak, and you can judge me as time goes on, I take it very personal. And Sean will tell you, I started a call every morning here in the city of Seattle. At 9 a.m., every precinct calls in. Every specialized unit calls in. They're on a conference call. And I want to know everything that happened overnight. Now, sometimes that call can take 8 or 9 minutes. And so if there's starting to be, say, burglaries, cars being broken into, houses being broken into in this section of town, in Fremont, in Ballard, we're ahead of it on a 24-hour basis. And tonight I skipped a meeting that I do every Tuesday night with not only Seattle police, line officers, the line officers we're talking about, but police officers from Federal Way, from Renton, from Kent, all of our surrounding communities, King County sheriffs, so that we cover this stuff every single day, because I take it personal. I take it personal in Seattle. I took it personal in Boston. And I think that's the effect that we're having, these type of discussions are having on your policing.
So when you hear that someone got stopped for a broken taillight and there was no broken taillight, do you take that personal as well?
Yes. That gets addressed immediately. And just so you know, the Office of Police Accountability is on that phone call at 9 o'clock in the morning.
All right. You have something to bring up. Sir?
This question is primarily for Megan, since you're pretty familiar with a lot of the history. But I guess the question is this getting worse? So there's been an increasing amount of attention over the past year or two. Is that as a result of the police force getting more violent, more racist, or is it simply more cameras? What are some of the factors that have been going into this increase of attention?
Thank you.
Great. I think that's an excellent question. So my work, like I said, is much more historical. And I think the short answer to your question is the reason why this is getting some more attention. Because a lot of my friends are like, oh my gosh, Megan, this is happening. I'm like, it's been happening for a very long time. But I think the reason why more people are now focusing on it is in part because of smartphones and television and kind of the quickness of social media. I think that's part of the reason. I think some of my frustration around that is that the way that some people are kind of just there, it's like this moment in time. And I think the long trajectory kind of why a lot of black people have a deep suspicion, not just these two women in the front, but like their friends, but why a lot of black people have a deep suspicion and distrust of police is not something that just happens because we see Michael Brown or we see kind of Freddie Gray, but that it goes back, and it's not even just Jim Crow. Like, I love Michelle Alexander's book, and I'm so glad you brought that up. But it's not just kind of this very much kind of fractured relationship between police and especially African Americans, but it goes even further back in terms of kind of like post-Reconstruction and the way that the criminal justice system was built in terms of to control black bodies. And then we move forwards in terms of Jim Crow. And a lot of black people have parents that experienced racist policing in the 50s, 60s, and the 70s. Like, this is real. So it's not, you know, and this is something that Sean alluded to earlier on in terms of sometimes distrust in the community. When somebody's like, I don't really feel like calling the police, in part, some of it stems from that. And some of it, it's not just like, oh, police didn't respond to me, but it's deeply violent interactions between the police, right? Like, if anybody knows a tiny bit about civil rights history, those dogs were not just there for, like, therapeutic dogs, right? Like, that's just not why they were there. Batons were not just there just for, like, show, right? Like, there was, like serious violence that happened to black people in the South and in the North and on the West Coast. So this is not all of a sudden this happens. It just, we just now see it played on ABC, CNN, and sometimes even Fox, right? Like, so I think that's why, and it's exciting.
They just tell it different.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, for that reason, I think I find it really exciting. But at the same time, while I'm encouraged with the use of, like, YouTube and videos, I'm not convinced that this is going to be kind of a fork in the road. In part because, like, you know, it's like, I agree with ideas, like I just said, about kind of stricter laws around accountability and kind of body cameras on police, but I'm not convinced that we would have to have those if we kind of worked out or like worked through and addressed kind of the way that racism impacts police policies. And I think that's the larger issue, right? Like, even though there was video, Eric Garner, like that still did not turn out into an indictment, right? Like, grand jury was like, not really, right? Even though he's like, I can't breathe, right? So I do think that we get kind of a certain level of awareness right now, and I'm excited, but it's a really, really long history that has placed us in where we are right now.
And even though there was video, there was still a death. We have our last two questioners here, so we're going to bang right through this. Sir.
I was going to thank you, but thank you, Professor, for coming and doing this. Appreciate it. First question is, can you justify weed and seed and the effects it had on the CD in Rainier Valley, on the breaking the relationship between the black community and the police officers, which it did over multiple generations because black people lost homes they owned in the CD for a long time. It's one of the main reasons why the CD will be 10% black. Also, can you explain your comment about Seattle being diverse? Because the statistics don't say that at all. Your question would be, how's a good way to frame this? The historical legacy and origins of policing, from the Pinkerton slave patrols to helping white people or immigrants become white in the North for the most part, the idea that the Nazis specifically copied and imitated policing in the U.S. and the judicial system, and then to the modern day where my uncles, grandparents, granduncles are telling me I have it worse off and my kid's going to have it more worse than I do than they did in the 60s. And then for you, like, you're not from Seattle. It was interesting to note that the other cities that you meet with are the cities where black bodies got pushed to out of the city. You didn't say Shoreline. You didn't say Montlake Terrace. You didn't say any of the northern suburbs. You specifically pointed to where black populations got pushed to because of weed and seed.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff, and I would like to.
So I can cover weed and seed as it played out in Boston, and I think.
I'm answer about Seattle.
Okay, so that's for Sean.
Answer about why you highlighted the cities where black people got pushed to.
So Montlake Terrace does come to the meeting. I was naming off a number of the cities. We have about 14 outside police departments, and plus our federal partners that both participate in the morning call and participate in the Tuesday night meeting, both from the north and from the south.
And Sean, Weed and Seed.
Right. So real quick, Weed and Seed, I'm going to go back a little bit further. Part of my police training, we talked about some of Seattle's history, some of Seattle's racist history, and how certain people could only own property in certain areas, and the long-term generational impact of that, those laws, and they aren't here now, but the impacts, I'm sure, are still felt, are inexcusable and unjustifiable. As far as Seattle being diverse, it's diverse, maybe not as racially diverse as other parts of the country, but it is diverse in ideas and backgrounds. It's a destination point for a lot of people who come here to work based on the economic opportunities through, you know, Amazon and Boeing and Microsoft and other jobs. It's a burgeoning world-class city. I'm proud to say that the department does reflect proportionally the community we serve. And yes, we are constantly recruiting from communities of color and women to ensure that the department continues to reflect the community.
Can you talk about Weed and Seed and not redlining?
So as far as Weed and Seed goes, that was something that, you know, I can't really speak to. I never worked in narcotics. I worked patrol. I worked in drug court from a Weed and Seed standpoint. I know that some of the drug court funding did come from Weed and Seed. I can tell you that we intervened in kids' lives. We intervened in adults' lives. I've dealt with people who were arrested with needles in their arm, passed out on the side of the street, who were given opportunities to go through treatment instead of going through the mandatory court sentencing that we talked about, so that way they could avoid going to prison because that's what they were facing. And I can also acknowledge that when someone goes to jail and or prison, there's a ripple effect. We're not talking about a short sentence or a long sentence. We're talking about lost jobs, lost incomes, impacts on families, impacts on children who are dependent on that provider. So I mean, you talk about some very important things, and the time simply doesn't do it justice.
Okay.
What did you want me, and what was your question about police?
The historical context of, like, where my grandparents and uncles, my elders are telling me I have it worse off as it relates to black relationship with cops, and that my kid is going to have it worse off than I do, when a lot of people think, and I've heard a lot up here, that we're better off than we were 30 years ago, where my elders in this city that we've been for, you know, six generations now, are, I'm actually worse off than them.
So I think part of that, so.
Oh, so pick up the microphone, please. Can you please pick up the microphone?
Sorry.
Thank you.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Yeah,
thank
hello.
You. Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody. So I think this is an excellent question, which actually draws on, you clearly did this on purpose, right, which draws on your questions to these other two gentlemen. I think I'm not willing to say it's going to be worse. I do hear the concern, and I think part of the concern has to do with, I feel like what some people consider, is the pushing out and the displacement of especially African Americans from the city, right? And so, especially like in the CD, at least kind of growing up, it felt like there was more officers. Like we had officers at Garfield, right? And like instead of kind of crazy stuff that happened that we just saw recently on the news, they were like, hey, like, come on over here, right? And or if there were fights at Garfield, there were fights all the time at Garfield, right? But like it was just a matter of like, hey, break it up, let's talk, right? Instead of, but now oftentimes in schools it's escalated on up, right? And individuals are arrested. So I do worry, especially in Seattle, about the displacement, especially of African Americans from the South Side and especially from the Central District. And I think, like, for that reason, that has created some concern, and I think that's probably what your parents are and kind of your elders are calling on. And I think that there's something to be said when kind of different communities feel like they actually have control and a stake at a central part in the city. Right, and so it's not just like neighborhoods, it's art galleries, it's different kind of places and community places where like black people used to go. Like, I mean, all the bars in the city are not the bars in the city anymore. They're like these hipster bars in which they're like, oh, what do you think of the neighborhood? Are you new? Because like this was a dangerous neighborhood, but now it's changing. And I'm like, oh my God, right? Because what they're saying right, is that it was a black neighborhood, and now it's becoming white and safe. So I definitely, yeah, I'm not sure.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And our final guest and questioner of the evening. Here you go, sir.
Hi, my name's Frank. I'm also new to Seattle. Been here a little over a year. So I'm still trying to get the lay of the land. I have a lot of locals that I know that I ask questions about, you know, the city and some of the racial dynamics. Sorry. Can you hear me now? Okay. My question isn't as macro as the last. It's a little more about interactions with police on a individual basis. I'm sure most of us saw the video today of the high school girl that was dragged out of her seat and flipped around. I went to high school in Texas, and you know we also had cops on campus, but I don't really remember you know any interactions with them being so aggressive. You know, even when kids were fighting, is like a break it up. So what has changed, you know, since I was in high school? I'm 34 now, that cops turn up the way they do over things that I feel like weren't such a big deal, especially in school settings. You know, like, is it a tick? Are cops being trained differently? And does that vary by city that, you know, they watch people differently and how they move before it turns into like the MMA aggressive pinning and dogpiling?
So I'll go back to the training is completely different, and I'll talk about some crisis intervention stuff that we're doing here in Seattle. But I just watched in deference to Fox, what I do is I watch CNN, I watch MSNBC, then I watch Fox, and then I try to piece it all together to figure out what really happened. But I watched Fox, and one of the things that came out on Fox was they interviewed a student, and she said that officer was known as the Slammer. Now, if the students know that his nickname was the Slammer, then administration must have heard that nickname, and folks in the police department at my level must have known that he was known as the Slammer. So right away, you know, and I'm not judging the officer. Because I wasn't there, you know. But I'm not condoning anything he did. But I'm saying if he was known as the Slammer, then that's not the first time that happened. So it's incumbent upon us in the administration, as you go up, first level supervisors, sergeants, lieutenants, to start spotting these things. And you know, one of the things that goes on in training now is this holistic approach to police officers, the whole police officer. And that's part of training. And I can tell you that there are those in policing, and many of them are the younger officers, not the older officers, because as you've been around for a while, and I know that, you know, well, is it the same it was 20 or 30 years ago? I went to high school in Boston during forced busing, so I can tell you what the police officers did, and they weren't looking at the color of your skin. Everybody was the enemy. 1972, 1973, 74, 75, I was in high school in Boston during court-ordered desegregation. And mind you, I lived in a predominantly minority community. So I know, you know, a little bit about aggressive policing, completely different than what it is now. But clearly, that's incumbent upon others. If that nickname was out there, then it's known. And that's, I think someone brought it up earlier, this lady right here. This blue shield shouldn't exist in any police department, big, small, or indifferent. Or whatever the term, thin blue line. And, you know, that's one of those terms that people like to look at. Well, the thin blue line, that's a dirty term. No, it's actually not. It's something that, you know, everyone has the right to go out and be free to walk around, to lock your car, to lock your home, to walk out and do whatever you want to do. And the police are supposed to be there to take care of that. But they're also supposed to do it in a manner that's even-handed and reasonable. So that officer clearly had some history, if that was his nickname, and someone should have intervened before that.
I guess to fine-tune my question a little bit, are officers trained to interact with people, you know, whether they're showing up to a rally or a politician's coming in there? Like, are they taught to look at that situation, you know, like, I need to be ready, go time? You know, to where, you know, because I've only been here a little over a year, and a couple of news stories will pop up where police are you know, I think there was a guy that was walking on the street with a cane of some sort. And
golf club.
Your golf club. And then, you know, I think a teacher, an activist, was walking by a rally downtown, got pepper sprayed in the face out of nowhere. Like, when... I don't know. You know, like, we had an officer come to our house a few months ago, actually, you know, because we had a couple of things stolen. And that interaction was perfectly pleasant. You know, very new, officer just moved here from, you know, one of the plain states, I can't recall. You know, and not that I was completely, you know, on guard, as, you know, most, I feel like, black people are instructed by their parents to, you know, behave a certain way. But, you know, my guard was completely down because he was coming to our needs, you know, at that moment. But, you know, is there something that, you know, in retrospect, I'm like, man, is there something I could have done that would have made him, like, switch and, you know, go into Hulk mode? Is there training for specific situations on how...
So when you talk about protests, the training that goes on... So I got here April 15th, so I was here for May Day. There was a march earlier in the day, immigration and labor march, that was well over 5,000 people. Not one problem. Earlier in the morning, that was around noontime, 9 o'clock in the morning, there was an MLK Day march, Black Lives Matter, close to 1,000 people, not one incident. Later on in the evening, there was the anarchist protest, which was about 125 to 225 individuals, and it was pandemonium. You know, and I would venture to say, although they all had masks on, based on my training and experience, that 95% of them or better were white. So the only time that there was any use of force used was to combat what was going on in the third march of the day. 5,000 people, I actually walked, and the way we did it in Boston was you actually get out and walk the streets. The bicycle officers did it here. We had 5,000 people at the immigration march and labor march. Not one incident. Officers had many interactions that day. Not one incident. You know, one of the trainings that I want to talk about, how things are different, we have something called CIT training, crisis intervention training, here in Seattle. In the past three months, Seattle police have done CIT interventions on, and I think any of us that have worked and driven through and been around downtown, we see a lot of individuals that are in crisis. 2,500 crisis intervention calls in 3 months the Seattle police have handled. So if you multiply that out by the whole year, that'll be 10,000 calls, just crisis calls. Those are individuals with mental health issues, with all kinds of crisis issues going on. Less than 0.1% of those 2,500 calls have involved any type of force, including handcuffing. So I think when we talk about how we train now, we clearly train differently. Because before, person in crisis like that who was flailing and you know, maybe seeing things that aren't there or whatever, would be handcuffed, called for an ambulance, strapped down to an ambulance with handcuffs and cut it off. That's not what's happening now. That's not what's happening at protest, and it's not what's happening, you know, across the country. Can it get better? Clearly, any of the examples that were brought up here today from... you know, folks here, from folks that feel they were being stopped with a broken taillight because they were black, those incidents have no place. The incident at the school, a girl decides, you know, she's going to be belligerent and talk on her cell phone and not leave the class. That's not the way that that's handled. That's not the way that's handled. Allegedly before. I wasn't there, you know, but even if she was, that's still not the way that it's handled. So... I mean, it's just, clearly there was some evidence that officer, if he's known as a slammer, someone had to intervene long before it got to what was on national television today.
Thanks. Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. I couldn't help but notice, once again, people who feel they were stopped because of a broken taillight. Just wanted to ask about that. So... You acknowledge, though, that happens sometimes, right? That people are stopped and there's no real broken taillight.
So I'll give you my example that I do with my students when I taught. Again, I taught, it was about 90-plus percent of the students in my class were persons of color. It gets considerably colder in Boston than it does here in Seattle, which is one of the reasons why I'm here. And so on the first class, I got to break the ice. I'm a police officer. I was working homicides when I first started teaching. Blue suit, white shirt, red tie, getting up there looking like George Bush. And I'm teaching a class entirely of students of color. So my January semester would start, and basically the attire was some type of work boot or snow boot, and mostly Timberlands, some type of jeans, either black or blue, some type of hooded jacket, navy blue, gray, or black. And again, my class was about 95% African Americans. So Bunker Hill is located at 250 Rutherford Avenue in Charlestown. So I would take the five, I would just go around the class. I probably could have picked 10 students out of the class, but I would take five students that were around the same height that appeared to be African American and that all had that attire on. And I would bring them up the front of the room. I would have someone in my department on a channel that normally isn't working, and I'd say, would you give me that description again for 250 Rutherford Avenue for the armed robbery? And they would say, we have a black male between the ages of 18 and 24, dark hooded sweatshirt, dark jeans, work boots. Okay. Then I would ask the class right across the room, if you were in a police car, would you stop this individual? Yes. Would you stop this individual? Yes. And I would go right down the line with that exercise. So now, as a police officer, you go to the first individual and say, excuse me, sir, you fit the description. Have you heard that before? And everyone in the class would say, yes, I've heard that. I've been stopped before because I've heard that. What happens at the end of that interaction is what makes the difference. So the individual would say, well, why are you stopping me? I was working at the 99. It's right across the street from Bunker Hill, and you let me leave. You got to let me leave. I say, okay, let me just explain to you what happened here. We had a robbery in the proximity. Get on the radio, and in the earshot of the individual that was being stopped, I would say, could you tell me what this incident is and what he's being stopped for? Now, that person probably is not happy that they were stopped, but they got a legitimate explanation as to why they were stopped, much different than a phony broken taillight. So those things happen in policing, and how the officer goes the extra mile to explain what they're doing, why they're doing it. If the taillight isn't broken and someone's being stopped for a broken taillight, then you go right down and make the complaint out, and we'll take it. But it's the reasonableness. Five individuals could be stopped for the same thing in the same area. If the officer just turned around and said, oh, you work at the 99, all right, screw, then that's not a good encounter with the police. The first way you handle it, explaining what the stop was, explaining why, letting him hear it on a radio, not from you, from somebody else, he may not be totally thrilled, but at least he got a legitimate explanation as to what was going on. We'd walked through that, and many of these individuals said to me, if we had been handled that way, we would have a totally different concept of police. That's the type of training that has to take place in policing.
All right. I'm going to wrap this up in 1 minute. What'd you learn tonight, Megan? Yeah, remember to get your microphone.
Sorry.
That's all right.
You have to come back to me. Let me give it.
Sean, what did you learn tonight?
Well, I'm not sure it's what I learned. It's what I was reminded of, just that there's a tremendous amount of work that needs to be done, that the presence of video, and actually I learned it from Megan, it's not so much that it's a fix. It's symptomatic of the reality of race relations in our country, and that the solution is going to be much, much deeper than technology.
Thank you. Solution much deeper than technology. Video is not a fix. Bob, what's one thing you learned tonight?
So one of the things I learned is, and listening to Megan and to some of the, you know, tremendous questions that came from the audience here tonight. So when we talk about things like the gentleman that talked about Weed and Seed was another failed attempt at the war on drugs that clearly had a disparate effect on minority communities or communities of color in this country. The war on drugs, mandatory sentencing, is something that has completely gutted whole communities across this country. And, you know, I think what I've learned is that folks that it didn't affect personally are just as angry and upset and enthused about writing it as folks that it did affect personally. And that I think that's a good thing for us.
That's legit. Megan?
Oh, man. Part of me feels like the gap is even bigger than I thought it was coming in. I feel like some of the questions and some of the discussion that we've had, it's people talking past each other. There's a real conversation that needs to take place, and it is taking place here and in other places around the country. But I still think that there's big boulders on both sides in terms of people who experience a particular type of trauma and people at some level who do the trauma. And then, like, in this kind of this wedge also about people who are trying to make it better. I think the problem is bigger than I thought, and I thought it was pretty damn big before I walked in here.
Problem's bigger than we thought. I would agree with that. I think that's legit. I have personal experiences that support that, and I understand what you're saying. And I would like to share that my brother was pulled over into an impromptu lineup one time in a train station because, quote unquote, a black guy came out of nowhere and did something. And they had the lineup, and it looked like Fat Albert. it was tall guys, short guys, heavy guys, skinny guys, guys in suits, and guys in work uniforms, and my brother. And they were all black. And the only reason they let my brother go was because I was standing there, and I said, "You have my brother." And I was rattled by that, and I feel naive to this day that I was rattled by it because it was something he was used to. And I am hearing that reflected in a lot of the things that you're talking about, and I think that it is bigger because I think the same thing could happen tomorrow in any American city. So thanks for being here.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. This event took place at Naked City Brewery and Tap House on October 27th. Thanks again to Humanities Washington, the panelists, Brian Miller and Zeki Barak Hamid for their assistance, and Anna Tatashev for our recording. Tune in again soon for more from Speakers Forum.